This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. We've been making cheese in Wisconsin since before we were even a state, which may be one reason why we win so many awards for it. It's what happens when a whole state dreams in cheese. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Welcome to Processing, a show about the intersection of food and grief with me, your host, Zara Tangora, and
me, your mom, Bobby Conforto.
Oh, hi, Bobby.
Hi, Zos.
I'm a chef. Bobby?
I am an ex-chef, and I am a bereavement psychotherapist.
Amazing. I just thought, you know, if we have any new listeners, they might want to know what our qualifications are. We're just two people. We're just talking about food and grief. We are just two people talking about food and grief, but we do have some kind of expertise in it.
And so the important part of our show is our guests.
Yes, that is very true. That's the whole crux of the show. We're so lucky to have these folks join us each week. Every time we get off of a talk with a guest, I'm just like so grateful, because I mentioned this last week in the intro when we were talking about Anthony, but it's an emotional heavy lift, but like not only for the hour. You know what I mean? It's not just like people talk to us for the hour and it's like the thought of preparing for it. It's the like decompression from it.
And the risk they're taking.
Yeah. But it's really extremely generous, because hopefully the goal is, and I know this from just hearing from listeners, is that it helps other people be able to kind of cope and get through what feels like the hardest time in life.
And talk about grief.
Yeah.
You know, to talk about it more. But what I'm always astounded by is the feeling of warmth afterwards.
Oh,
and
yeah.
How our guests, including Lavanya today, just felt that she had a good experience, that she felt nourished and she felt good about sharing. She said that she came on the show to kind of unpack, if this would be a way that she could unpack her grief, and she felt satisfied with that.
Yeah, it was great. I mean, every time we get off of a recording, Bobby and I call each other on the phone and say, oh my God, that show was so good. And today we're actually happen to be together sitting side by side, because we're celebrating my stepdad and Bobby's husband, Rob, his 70th birthday this weekend. So let's give just a little shout out to Rob Conforto, celebrating 70
Yay.
Years, nicest person, sweetest guy. And we're so happy to be celebrating him. So today on the show, we are joined by Lavanya Nambiar, who is not only a friend and a wonderful person, but also I'm so blessed that she is my downstairs neighbor. Mm. And we really formed a bond, as we'll talk about on the show, over sharing food with each other. And we found it as a way to kind of become quick friends. And also, like, I think both come from a background of showing food as love and wanting. And because of that, we formed a really special connection. Mm. You know, I feel lucky. I live in a building where it's a small building. There's only four apartments and everyone is so amazing. I also have such a wonderful close relationship with my upstairs neighbor, Kari. And a big part of it is just through how we share with each other. And it's really cool. And I know it's not possible everywhere, but if it feels like it is, I guess I want to encourage people to try it out. And that's saying that with a grain of salt, knowing it isn't possible for everyone.
Well, you know, I knew when I heard that you started to bring food around to your neighbors, I put a big smile on my face, because it's part of your warmth. And when I realized that you had knitted together a community by your generosity and your warmth.
Well, it's by everybody. Everybody. Yeah. It's a communal thing. And it is. Thank you for saying that. And it's really nice. And it's just, the world is hard to be in. You know what I mean? That is a fact. And no matter what happens with COVID or with really anything, it's still going to be a hard place to be in. And so I think personally, and I know everyone has a different idea of what a solution for that can be, my solution is to start with my immediate surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Because frankly, I think it's very hard to make a bigger impact if you don't start with your immediate surroundings and the little things you can do, right?
Yes.
And then it grows from there. And then hopefully that gives us the, you know, force we need to kind of meet some of the challenges of the world. And that being said, even if it just brings a little joy to the day, right?
Yes,
even
yes.
Like life is hard. It's not going to globally and in a major way get easier. So we have to find ways to make every day easier in the little ways we can.
Sing it, sister.
You know?
I agree.
And I think that sometimes you don't get to live next to the best people or let's just say people who you connect with, because I don't like to say best people or worst people. Sometimes you aren't lucky enough to live next to people who you connect with. But if you can find ways to connect, I recommend it. And like, I also have like a super close relationship with my next door neighbor who lives in the building next to me, who, you know, especially in this time where like people feel like you need to share political ideologies to get along, like we don't, him and I. And yet I jokingly refer to him to new people as my best friend. He's like 75 years old, but he kind of is my neighbor Al. I love him, you know? And so, but what I'm, the point of all this is not to brag about how much all my neighbors love me. The point of it is just to say again, that like life can be challenging. So if we can make nice things for ourselves that don't cost anything other than our openness, it can make a big difference. And if you're out there and you're listening and you found yourself in a slump or a rut or things not going the right way, you know, you can look online and say, how do I change my life? And it's like, well, go to the gym and, you know, go figure out how to start your own business and all these things that seem daunting. And truly, I think that like these things can start to feel better when you start small.
Share food, share love.
Yeah. And just share yourself. Yes. Open up a little bit. It's hard. That's hard. That's one of the things I think about when you're grieving or when you're in a bad place. That's hard. That's a big thing to do, is to open your heart. I remember when my dad died, like I couldn't even look people in the eye. I found myself realizing, because I had also been going through a heartbreak at that time. And even when I go through smaller griefs, like heartbreak or losing something, I find it hard to look people in the eye. And I notice that things start to change when I can do that again, when I make a conscious effort to like look up and smile and make eye contact. And so sometimes it just starts there with like a smile, and it's hard, but it's worth it. And I hope that anyone out there who's having a hard time can find these like little things. So anyway, our talk with Lavanya was beautiful and just so appreciative to her. And so it's always wonderful to hear about, I don't know, just how different culturally different people process death, what the culture is surrounding death in different cultures. So yes. I thought that was very interesting.
And absolutely.
Thank you to Lavanya for your time. We love you and thank you so much, and take care of yourselves and each other.
Thank you. Bye.
We are joined today by friend, neighbor, all-around wonderful human being, Lavanya Nambiar, and she's joining us live from my building in Carroll Gardens, and I am in Bobby's house today in an unusual turn of events, but yet we are all here together, and it's a beautiful October morning, and I'm so excited that you joined us today and that we get to chat and hear more about your story and your life. You're a wonderful neighbor and a wonderful friend, and now we are psyched to have you on Processing. So welcome.
Thank you so much, Sarah. Nice to meet you.
So nice to see you.
Yeah.
And Bobby, you finally, I get a chance to meet you. I've heard your voice all this while. So yeah, it's great. And it's a nice, bright October morning and looking forward to unpacking everything.
Yeah, we're really psyched to have you. So we met about a year ago when you and your partner, Kevin, moved in downstairs in our lovely little street over in Carroll Gardens. And it's just been like a really fast friendship. I think we just like immediately had a great connection. And I mean, we're lucky that we have a friendly building and everyone is sweet and friends and nice. But I think we have a special connection and we, you know, share food with each other, and you bring me up some of the delicious, amazing things that you make, and I'll bring you down what I'm making. And I think, like, I don't know, it makes the building feel special and kind of like what neighbors used to do for each other, you know, and I think it breaks down some of the stigma of like the cold New York vibe, because I know New York to actually be a warm place, you know, and it feels nice to kind of keep up those neighborly traditions with you.
It's funny you say that, because when I moved into the U.S., like I was here by myself to pursue my master's in 2016, there was this lack of warmth. Like, I feel like it was very individualistic and everyone's chasing their own dream and nobody's got time for anybody, like, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
I would go to Times Square to cry out, like, you know, there were times when I would just sit and cry by myself.
Yeah.
And,
oh, and
I would miss home.
Times Square is like it's weird because it's like the loneliest place to be probably in New York because it's busy, but it's also just full of like speeding around tourists and, you know, but I think that's the thing about New York, right, is that once you actually live here for a while, and not to say that it's for everyone, but I think once you kind of live here for a while and get the lay of the land, you find the, like, the neighborhoods that are warm and friendly and you can find your way into, like, you know, and I know that isn't necessarily the experience for everyone, but as someone who's spent pretty much my whole life in New York, I feel that that can be true if you just, you know, it's just harder in a big place. You have to look for those pockets of, like, familiarity. But it is really true also in, like, I mean, the rugged individualism in America in general, you know what I mean, is, I think, unfortunately, just becoming more and more prominent as a thing as time kind of goes on. And
when did you first come to the United States?
So I first came to the United States in 2011,
mm-hmm.
to pursue my master's in biotechnology in Buffalo, actually, believe it or not.
Wow, Buffalo.
And yeah, I slipped into depression. I was like really upset and sad there. And I realized I don't want to pursue this career.
Mm.
I want to do something like public health policy. So I just left. I abandoned everything and I went back home and started from scratch. Like in public health.
Wow. And home for you, you grew up in and were born and raised in New Delhi, India, correct?
Correct. Yeah. My parents are from a southern state in India called Kerala.
Mm-hmm.
But I was raised in New Delhi all my life. And I worked there extensively in public health before coming back to the United States in 2016 to pursue my master's in public health policy from Columbia University.
That's amazing. Just that whole area up there by Columbia. Did you live up there when you came to study there?
I lived in Washington Heights.
Okay. Yeah.
Amazing.
I lived there too, actually, for a long time when I was in college.
Oh, you did.
I went to FIT my first apartment out of college was up there by Columbia University. And it's a really interesting, beautiful, cool neighborhood there.
When you first came, what was it like for you when you first came here?
So when I came into Buffalo, I had it was shocking for me, you know, what you see in the movies in Hollywood. And I was like, wait, this is America? And as soon as I got here, I got like bed bug infestation in my apartment. I was like, oh my God, I've never known what bed bugs were back in India, which is supposedly third world. And I come here and it's horrible, absolutely horrendous.
That's a really bad thing to happen. That happened to me when I was in college. And it just feels, it's like, it feels never ending. You know what I mean? You're like, oh, like, when will this be over? Like, how do I even wrap my head around this, like, annoying, you know? And then it's like your sleep too, you know, like you just want to, the world can be so difficult to navigate. And like, when you go to sleep, you just want to feel peaceful and comfortable. That's a hard thing to deal with, like coming, you know, right out of the gate.
That wasn't very welcoming, right? It wasn't very welcoming to have bed bugs.
It wasn't. So when I was moving here, I was like, you're really eager to, you know, start my own life and get away from my family and, you know, break all those bonds. I was very rebellious. When I came here, I was like slowly understanding the value of all that love, that warmth, that affection. I missed all of that. And I was like, wait, I want to visit my family again. Like in 6 months, I went back and went back as in to visit my parents, and I would do that every 6 months because I could not bear staying away from my family.
Yeah, of course.
Who's at home? Who is your family at home?
So I'm my parents' only child. So.
Wow, me too.
So
we have so much in common. In that way.
Oh, you do, yeah. So it was really hard for me. And so it's my mom and my dad. And my dad was, for a big chunk of my childhood, my dad was working in the Middle East. So it was more like just my mom handling everything. And she had a job. And so I spent a lot of time, you know, craving for that feeling, like that affection, like, you know, when will my mom come back? And
yeah,
just staying by myself. So we did that, and we have a very close knit family because, you know, family means it's a big deal in India. Like, not the immediate family, but, you know, your cousins and your sisters. So for me, my cousins are my siblings, like, yeah, literally. And so the person I'm going to talk about is my aunt, who's my mother's younger sister, and who passed away in May recently, yeah, due to COVID. And we were like family. I would call her mama, yeah, which is like, she was like my mother. So, you know, I spent a lot of time at their place, their apartment, and their son is literally like my sibling. So, mm-hmm, like, I call him my brother, not, yeah, my cousin.
Totally. And so, I mean, so that's kind of how, you know, we connected in terms of thinking about having you join us on the show, is that, you know, your aunt who you just mentioned, what was her name?
Her name is Shobana.
Beautiful. You had come upstairs and we chatted, and I, you know, could just tell that something was wrong. And I knew it was your birthday the previous day, I think, when we had talked. And you looked so sad, and I kind of just knew something was wrong. We kind of connected over you sharing that you had this grief experience with the loss of your aunt who you were so close with. As you mentioned, she died from COVID-related complications, right? And, you know, I was just struck by the fact, but what it feels like to have someone be sick when you can't be there. It's such a challenging, really terrible thing to happen. And it adds a whole nother layer of complication to the grief, because it's like the loss. And then I think within every loss, to what level this exists is different for everyone. But there's an amount of guilt and associated with it and regret. And it's not like that. It's not based in reality most of the time, because there's generally nothing you can do about it. But
it's the powerlessness.
Right. But I think like being away from someone, I know that I experienced that in a smaller scale because it was much closer. But when my father was sick, he lived in North Carolina, and there were times when he'd become so ill and was on the brink of death. Like, I just couldn't be there. I'd leave and come back or whatever. And that feeling, yeah, of powerlessness and of just not being able to be present, you know, being able to be present is so hard, but it also is a healing thing. It's a way to like move through a painful grief experience. And so I really felt for you in that moment. Can you just, I guess, kind of talk to us about, you know, what were you feeling in that time? Cause it was a while from when your aunt became sick to when she passed away, right?
Right. So she tested positive for COVID in April. So basically, she had planned her daughter's wedding. She also has a daughter. Mm. So she had planned all her wedding because she just knew deep down that, you know, it'll come to an end. Like, you know, she just knew it. Mm. I don't know. She went to an astrologer, and he said the same thing, which is so strange. And so she had prepared for it, like, you know, saved money in the bank account separate for her daughter for the wedding and everything. Like, she was preparing for it. And then the wedding was supposed to happen on April 5th, I believe. And the groom got tested positive for COVID.
Oh, no.
And so obviously they had to cancel everything. And she was really bummed out. She was really sick, and she never told any of us. Like, we knew she had liver cirrhosis, but she never told us how bad it is. Mm. And she would collapse in the bathroom and stuff. This, her kids revealed this later on. So then on April 13th or 15th, she tested positive for COVID. Mm. And she used to work at the hospital. So even despite the fact that she worked at the hospital, she struggled to get even an oxygen tank because her oxygen saturation was going down, falling like to 60 something and 50. So she really badly needed an oxygen tank, and we could not procure one. And then finally they got like an ICU bed for her. And initially she was talking and stuff, but then from there it was downhill.
What, like, a frantic feeling to hear the news of her situation and to know that. What could you do when you say, we tried to get things for her? Did you try from here to get supplies for her and things?
So I tried contacting people in India, because at that point, everyone was posting on Instagram, this person has these many oxygen tanks. Oh my God, absolute despair and misery. Can you imagine, like, you are not able to help your parent even get to a hospital or get admitted to a hospital. And it's just, everyone was feeling helpless. Like, my mom has so many connections and she's been able to get all these things done, like, with, especially with the government. But this time, everyone failed. And then finally, they got a hospital bed and ICU. And then it's just downhill, like, her organs started failing. And because she had cirrhosis, then that worsened the situation.
Of course.
She was also diabetic, so.
Yeah.
And I remember clearly, like, asking her to get vaccinated, like, 15 days before the wedding. I was like,
was it possible in that time for her to do it?
So she worked at the hospital, so it was possible for her. But she was like, oh, I've heard so many things about the side effects. And we need to get our daughter married, so, you know.
Yeah.
I'll do it after the wedding.
That's really hard, you know? I mean, it's just, there's so many terrible complications as a result of what's happened with this pandemic and, you know, messaging globally, and also reasonable concern about vaccines, because they haven't, you know, I mean, I believe in the vaccine, and I believe in, obviously, it as a means to an end of this whole situation. But, you know, it's reasonable for people to be curious about things that are going into their body and to be scared. And if there's not clear messaging and there's not, you know, like stuff like that, it is hard for people. It's reasonable for people to be skeptical and scared. You know what I mean? Especially at first. And at this point now, we have seen that it's, like, you know, working. But, you know, I also just am struck by, like, what you're saying in kind of relation to vaccination and stuff like that, you know, like, where people and kind of tying to what you're talking about the rugged individualism, is that, like, especially in this country, we're predisposed to being concerned with self first, you know what I mean? Always, really. And that's almost, that's the messaging for Americans. And the problem is that there's all these folks who live in this country and all over the world who are affected by the decisions that we make, that we think, like, when we think of only ourselves. And, you know, like, I don't know many people who are just wholeheartedly psyched to get vaccinated. It's strange. It's scary. It's a thing going in your body you don't know about. It's, if we didn't have to do it, wouldn't that be better? You know what I mean? Like, but we do it because there's a bigger picture, you know? And I think it's very easy to pretend like there's not. And that goes for a lot of things, but it's important. And I'm so glad you're on sharing with us, like, that it's a bigger picture and it affects people in ways you would be completely unable to understand. Do you know what I mean? Like, in terms of just what you're saying, being someone whose beloved family member is thousands of miles away, and, like, how heartbreaking that is for you to not be able to have any real agency over being able to say goodbye or make an impact. And the fact that, like, the decisions we make here thousands of miles away, you know what I mean? And how we think of people, you know, in a global sense, can help people like yourself not have to go through that type of painful situation. You know what I mean? And I hope that anybody listening can kind of understand that if they're still curious or on the fence about whether to become vaccinated or take that on for themselves, it's worth it, because we are all human beings and we owe to ourselves and each other to care about each other.
Right.
You know, it's important.
And I also, like, all I can do sitting here is, you know, ask them to get vaccinated. And that's, I tried really hard and I really forced my parents to do that. Thankfully they got it before it became unavailable there. Right. Yeah. So, and then she did not. And in May, I was like, you know, horrible month. Like, every day was like another bad news, like, about her, you know, liver is going to fail her. Everything was failing. It was like, she slipped into coma as well. They wouldn't call it, my family wouldn't call it coma, because, you know, the stigma attached to it, obviously, for a good reason. So they were like, yeah, she'll respond. She's not responding right now, but the doctor said it's coma. She's in coma right now. And
are you trying to say that they didn't want to scare you? Is that what you mean? That they didn't want to use words that would frighten you?
Yeah.
They wanted you to have
they
hope?
Tried not to.
Yeah.
Or say it out loud. Like, yes. They were kind of in, I mean, they didn't want to admit it's coma.
Right. Of course. And that's a thing that happens a lot, too, because, like, this is all so much for people to grasp, whether it's losing someone to COVID or anything else. Like, it's so human to, like, not that it's necessarily the healthiest thing to do always, but it's extremely human to not be able to, you know, I mean, isn't that one of the stages? I mean, I know we don't totally subscribe to the stages of grief anymore, but it is, like, denial is, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, actually, the stages that Elizabeth Kubler-Ross talked about, which have to do with, you know, denial and anger and bargaining and grief and acceptance really fit more to the dying process than they do to the grieving process.
Right, because the grieving process has so much nuance in it.
So what you're describing is that your family, I'm sure you noticed all those things, right? You know, in the beginning that, you know, this can't be true. How could this be true? And, you know, the family not wanting to really accept that she was dying, and probably the signs were there, you know, that that's what was happening, but we don't want to believe that, you know?
Yeah.
And deep down inside, I knew that, you know, if this was going to happen. Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, you were saying something?
Oh, no, it's fine. I'm thinking of something you shared with us prior to the show about how you had been processing some of this, this anxiety around your aunt's illness with chanting and praying. And I just was hoping that you could kind of talk to us a bit more about that, because I think ritual also, in whatever form it comes, is a very interesting way of, I almost think of it, and tell me what you think. I know the intention is to do these things, whatever the ritual might be, to help the other person. And I'm in no way saying that it doesn't, but I also think of it as really, when we distill it, a way to help ourselves get through it. And I'm wondering what your thoughts are regarding that.
So I was chanting throughout, you know, her illness. Like, when she got admitted to the ICU, I started chanting. And I normally chant. I'm, like, not religious, I would say, but spiritual. Mm. And my parents are Hindu. So so in Hinduism, we believe in rebirth, right? And moksha, which is liberation from death or mortality. So when we knew that her, you know, situation is worsening, I started chanting, or my mom suggested I should chant Mrityunjaya Mantra. It's called Mrityunjaya Mantra, which is basically chanting for her liberation. Like, it literally translates to, like the fruit falls off from the bondage of the stem, may we be liberated from death and from mortality.
I love that. I remember when you told me that when we were talking right after your aunt passed away. And I thought it was one of the most kind of touching things, and also one of the most honest things I've heard about death and dying, about the ripe fruit, the ripest fruit falling from the tree. And really, really had an impact. I think about it often.
Yeah, because we might want them to stay and, you know, live, but suffer. For our selfish interest, maybe, you know, because we want that person around, but we could see that she was suffering, and there was no way that she would be 100% even if she survived, you know. So after a while, we were like, you know, just we need a result. Like, you know, she should be fine, as in she should get liberation from all this trouble, like, soon. And on my birthday, I had this horrible feeling. Like, I woke up and I was like, it's a bad day. It's going to be a bad day. I just knew it. And I could not do anything. Like, we went to the botanical garden just because I like plants. And I could not enjoy it at all because I had this gray cloud over my head. And I didn't know why, but I had a feeling and an inkling that something bad's going to happen. And I would check my phone again and again. And then we go in for my birthday dinner, and my partner gets this text from my mom that, you know, you should tell her that she passed away at 3:15 a.m. or something. And he kept it from me because he didn't want to, you know, break out the news while we were having dinner with his family. It would be weird for me. So he kept it to himself, and he was acting very strange. And then we were driving back and my cousin, she texted me like, she's no more. And I was like, what? I was in absolute disbelief. Like, I could not believe it. And then I remember like just crying for like 30 minutes in the car. We stopped over at a Dunkin' Donuts. Just cried there for like half an hour. And then, you know, I started piecing everything together. I was like, okay, so, you know, she was suffering. So this is, I guess, fine. And then I made sure I call up my cousins because I had another aunt who passed away in 2017. And I couldn't be there for my, I could not muster the courage to be there for my family because I was still figuring out my emotions. But I feel like I, you know, I could not live up to that big sister image of mine. So
right.
I hated that.
Were these the most major losses in your life? Had you had any losses prior to this? Your two aunts?
My grandfather, but that was old age. So yeah. No, none. Touch wood.
Yeah.
And I think it's very profound, the fact that you were not near them. It's so, I think, our Zara and I are sitting here listening, and I'm sure the listeners are hearing the same thing. Just that it must be so hard not to have been there, because, you know, when you're there, not that you can do anything to change it, but you feel like you're a part of it. And it must have been such a strange thing to be in the city and be out to dinner for your birthday, and it's so different than what was going on back home.
Yeah. And it made no sense. Like, when I found out and we come in to enter Carroll Garden, like this whole area, Gowanus and everything. And I'm like, this makes no sense. Like, you know, it all comes down to life and death. So why are all these people dining out? Why are everyone's enjoying? Like, it makes no sense.
I know.
And
it's strange. Yeah, it's a strange juxtaposition to actually be existing in that world even still, of so many people suffering and dying, and then just other people living life like everything's normal, which I also don't necessarily think is a bad thing. In some ways, it's like, well, if this is, everything is so bleak, if death is so close to all of us, closer than ever, then shouldn't we eat and drink and have fun? But then it's like, again, then that spins itself again on its head. It's like, well, at whose expense, and who are these servers who have to be, you know, it's such a complicated issue. But yeah, I just think that something that I find interesting about everything you're saying is, like, you know, you came to New York, to Buffalo, for the first time and experienced the feeling of the individualism and being away from, you know, your home where family and community was more important. And one thing I do think we don't have a great handle on here, generally speaking, and of course there are sections of great community throughout the country, but largely community, we are not community focused. And so to come here and feel the individualism and be struck by it in a painful way. And then to, I'm imagining, and tell me if I'm correct, in, you know, the moment of finding out your aunt had passed and not being able to be there, and then being the individual, you know what I mean? Not as like a selfish individual, but just being individual, you and your partner together, kind of, but not community, you know, focus. And I am imagining not the same as it would feel had you been home in India with your family. And I'm also curious to know, well, first of all, whether or not that makes sense to you. But secondly, what is the community, some of the community traditions surrounding death in India, where you're from?
So death, you, of course, mourn and you grieve, right? And yeah, you talk about that person. I feel like, you know, I didn't have that many losses, right, personally. But, and I've never been to a funeral, to be honest.
Wow.
But I know, so my mom kept me very protected from that. Like, if she would go, she would go in, but she'd be like, you stay back home. Like, you don't need to go. And then it's a very, I don't know, it's about, because you're transitioning from one life to another. That's how we look at it in Hinduism. Like, so it's basically the soul leaving the body and going into, you know, transitioning. So
sure.
We consider it a very pure process. Everyone's wearing white, firstly.
I love that.
White is the color for that. And yeah, so we basically chant for them, for the one who passed away, and just pray for them. But and food on the 13th day, I believe, you're supposed to feast people. Like, they are supposed to be a big feast, feeding everyone, open to everyone.
Nice.
Especially those who need food.
What do you mean everyone? You mean everybody, not just family, people in the whole community?
Whole community. Mm. Anyone can come and have the lunch because, yeah, that's open to... Because you're supposed to do good. That's part of the intentional action, right? Because that translates to your rebirth, to, you know, how... I know it sounds a little selfish because you are doing all these intentional action to...
No, it sounds really beautiful. And I'm curious, obviously, being that, you know, we are two... Bobby's a former chef and I'm a chef and a lover of food. What are some traditional things like in Indian culture when there's funeral ceremony, or just maybe even not necessarily for the funeral? Is there anything around the home that is specific, or even just in your own family's traditions?
So my parents are from South India. My family is from South India. It's a state, small state called Kerala, which is down south by the sea. Mm. And so we eat lots of fish normally. Mm. We can even eat fish for breakfast if need be. So that's how it works. And lots of coconut and fish, and not too spicy food. Unlike what's in, you know, the image of Indian food here is more like butter, chicken, and all that right. heavy stuff. But we are, diet is more like fish, coconut-based fish, curry. So it's really good. So during funeral, it's more like a 7-course meal with, you know, what puri is?
Puri.
Puri is like a fried bread.
Oh,
fried
yes.
bread.
Right.
So if it's in North India, it's like puri and like maybe, it has to be vegetarian though. If it's funeral.
Oh, interesting.
Or funeral ceremony. Yeah. Because, again, Hindus are not supposed to consume meat.
Right. Of course.
And
does that include fish as well? Is that under the bracket of meat? Okay.
Mostly, yeah.
Yeah.
No fish.
Yeah.
So it's puri and a variety of curries, different curries. It could be dry, could be... watery, and of course desserts, like a rice pudding or something. So it's like a 7-course. It's big, and you're supposed to celebrate. It's supposed to taste good, or maybe something that person liked.
Yeah, that's
so. That's
beautiful.
What we did.
That's what you guys did. Our family. That's awesome. Mm-hmm. So what did you have?
I mean, I didn't do it, but
I understand. No, I mean, but. I didn't know if, like, you know what your parents did. Like, what was your aunt's favorite thing?
So she likes green beans. We made, my family made that. And it's called, something called avial, A-V-I-A-L. It's like a mishmash of all the vegetables with a coconut base. And you add some coconut milk. So it's similar to Thai curry, but not exactly Thai curry, but... Yeah, so that and rice. So all her favorite stuff.
Yeah, that's really, I mean, that's beautiful. And I think that the more I learn about how different cultures around the world handle end of life and death and rebirth, and, you know, it is often more celebratory, I think, than what we do here in America. And I tend to think that's because we don't really talk a lot about death here in a way that is, you know, it's kind of something to be swept under the rug and something that's just very scary. Is death something that is kind of openly talked about? And I guess I'm just going on that you said that, you know, the funeral tends to be more of a celebration, which I think is beautiful. I mean, it's also difficult because it's like sometimes very tragic. You know, and sometimes when someone dies of old age, not that it's not very sad, but it feels more like it makes sense, right? And when someone doesn't die of old age, it often can be very tragic. So I'm just amazed by how people can still muster the that beautiful spirit to celebrate. You know, I think it's a beautiful thing. And I'm wondering if it has anything to do with, like, in your culture and in your family, was there more of a conversation around death as less of a scary thing? I mean, how did you guys speak about it?
Yeah, we talk about death openly because my mom's very clear about it. Like, you know, when I get upset that, you know, at some point you'll die, and then my mom is like, you know, we all die. That's fine. And you'll have to accept this. She always said that. Even when I was a kid, she would say that you have to make peace with the fact that I will die one day. Mm. And that's natural. Yeah. And so, you know, of course, I would want them to. Yeah. But like, sudden death is not something, nobody wants it, right? But with old age, yes, like we all talk about it, and we would rather die than suffer in pain and because of, you know, sickness and illnesses, all kinds of illnesses that people have. That, so like, for instance, I had my grandmother who had dementia for a very long time. Mm. I did not mention her because I'm not very close to her. Yeah. I wasn't very close to her. But yeah, she would lay there in the bed. She couldn't talk. So that is, I would say that's misery and suffering.
Yeah,
and
that's very hard. I would
not want that on anybody. So yeah, death was up for discussion. And even my aunt, she had prepared her kids for death. Like, she would say, like, it feels like she brought it upon herself in some way. My mom keeps saying that she always spoke about death all the time. Like, she would be like, you know, if I die, you should not wear this. She would tell her kids that.
Like, I love that.
During my ceremony, you're not wearing this, okay? Like, literally preparing everybody for her funeral, yeah. Which is strange and so morbid.
Yeah.
I mean, well, think about it. She worked
in healthcare too, right? So I guess she was used to it. You know I worked in hospice for many years, for 12 years, and we would sometimes be astounded that in some of our group meetings, we would be laughing. It was because it was just a subject that we were just used to, and we would almost have to make humor out of it sometimes, but it was a familiar subject that we talked about all the time. So I imagine for your aunt that she was, what did she do in the hospital?
She was a health administrator, so she managed the labs and everything. She worked at a medical school / hospital, so so labs and students and everything. So health admin, she saw it all. But and her health was, she was in a very bad state already before COVID, so she just knew that, you know, it'll happen earlier for her, if nothing else. And so she was prepared, and she even built, like, she had multiple houses that her kids have that are fight over property and everything, which is so strange, like, you know.
Yeah, it is.
It's creepy almost, like, preparing for it.
It is, but it's also, like, I don't know.
It's real.
Yeah, it's real. And it's just, like, it's one of those things that we always think, like with anything terrible or even good, like winning the lottery, which is, you know, maybe more complicated than good, but you know what I mean? Like anything that's a surprise that you think only happens to other people, which, you know, for stuff like that, that's extreme, you know, good or bad, it usually does just happen to other people. But death does happen to everybody. It really does. Yet it feels like something that doesn't. It feels like something that only happens to other people. And I think that, like, being able to face it as fearlessly as possible is a hugely high practice, you know, like any other high practice that, like, we can do spiritually. I think that preparing for death is about one of the highest. And I know that in a lot of other cultures around the world and a lot of other faiths, and even people who are not faith-based, people who are atheists, are able to prepare for death. And it seems strange, you know what I mean? And it seems morbid, but, like, and maybe it is, you know, but maybe it's kind of, like, liberating too, because there is such, like,
fear of death.
And in the fear of death, there's a lot of constriction, you know? It really, I think, makes us do all kinds of things that we don't even realize. How the choices we make based on the fear of dying, you know what I mean? Like, because it's like bargaining. We'll almost do anything to make it not real or something, but it is real. And I don't know.
You sound Buddhist.
Well,
you know, because really the Buddhists say death is inevitable. Yeah. And they talk about it throughout their practices.
Yeah.
But I think when we go through a death experience, and unfortunately you had to do it long distance, but when we go through the death of somebody we love, we learn a lot. And I think most people can become less afraid when they go through it instead of more afraid, particularly if there's support. That's right. Why I loved being in hospice so much, because it meant supporting families who started off with fear. And in the end, they ended up having more faith or less fear, more hope. And so that process of trusting the process of what happens in the dying process, which is inevitable, we can't change it. And that's what we realize. It's the things we can't control, you know?
Yeah.
But I think you missed, unfortunately, you heard it on the phone and you heard it from your family, but because you didn't get to see it. And of course, with COVID deaths, that was unfortunately a constriction that was very difficult for people because they couldn't be there.
Right. Which is another reason to just enforce. And believe me, I'm not trying to, I don't know, to use this platform to force people to get vaccinated, but just as something to think about, that is what we are taking from people if we do not participate in being part of the solution, is keeping people from being able to, I mean, there was space that separated you, but in general, it is a very horrible thing to not be able to be with your loved one when they pass away. And that is something that we are, you know, taking from people by not being part of the solution.
Because I think you mentioned in one of the, in your writing to us, that it was hard to process this. And I think when we can be there, there's something about it that helps us process it in a better way.
Yeah.
What has the grief been like for you? So this happened in May, and what's it been like for you since?
So in May, I was in a very bad state because, you know, I was working and I had started going into work, and I had this tremendous guilt because I feel like I couldn't catch up with her enough or talk to her. And when she was in the hospital, I am getting information about her at like third degree or fourth degree. Like, you know, my cousin would call my mom would call another aunt. And then, so through several different channels. And so I could not directly call my cousin and speak to her. And that's my biggest regret, because I could not speak with her. And last year, another aunt of mine got diagnosed with metastatic breast cancer.
Mm.
So from that day on, I would call her every day. I still call her because I felt like that's more urgent.
Mm-hmm.
So, but this aunt of mine, she was like, oh, does she not know I have liver cirrhosis? Like, you know, she was basically saying like, do I not know how serious her situation is?
Right.
I did not. And so I regret the fact that I never called. So this constant guilt, like, you know, I wasn't able to catch up with her or talk to her. And she was a jokester. Like, she would love joking all the time. Like, at other times when she was at the hospital, she would joke with the nurses and make everybody laugh. She was that person. So I was like, the last time I spoke was right before my cousin's wedding. And she was like, aren't you coming? And I was like, I can't come because of COVID and the whole, my paperwork. That's a different discussion. But so I could not. And so there was this guilt. And then I was like, I just compartmentalized my feelings. And I was like, even at work, I cried once with my colleague when I told her about this. And I was like, you better not tell anybody else at work, because I don't want to cry and make a big deal about it at work. Even though there's everybody else to sympathize, they're really nice people I work with. But I was like, no, I do not want to show my emotions out.
Yeah.
But I also started having sleepless nights after that. Like my body started itching and I was like, could not sleep the whole night. It was my anxiety manifesting in that way, maybe.
I feel like guilt when somebody passes away is so, like, we kind of touched on this in the beginning. It's very normal. I feel like I certainly don't want to speak for all the grievers in the world, but I'd venture to say that most people who are grieving have some level of feeling of guilt. I think that, like, loss is so difficult to process and understand. It's so like, we want solutions. We're human beings. We want solutions. We want something. If your finger is cut, you want a Band-Aid. If you're thirsty, you want to drink water. And when you're grieving, there is no actual immediate solution. You just have to really go through it and maybe go through it forever in some way or another. And so I think part of, like, guilt is, like, is a search for solution. So if I can turn this on me in some way, I can make some sense of it. And we're constantly grasping for a way to make sense of it. And if we make the problem us, well, then if the problem's me, then I can shoulder this. I can do the work through it. I can blame myself. It was, you know what I mean? It's hard to sit and accept that life is like this. You know what I mean? It really is. It's hard to look at yourself in the mirror and say, life is just like this. It's fucked up sometimes. It's deeply unfair sometimes. And I actually just have to sit with this pain until it starts to integrate into my life more. You know what I mean? And that's such a hard thing. And I don't know. I mean, this is a hypothesis. If that's why guilt exists, I think there's probably, it's maybe a bit more like nuanced than that.
I can address that a little bit. You know, I think that, you know, first of all, one of the tasks of grief is that we review our relationship, we review our interactions, and sometimes there are certain regrets or resentments that come up, and it's part of what we process during the grieving process. But I think, Zara, you were very right that the powerlessness, I use that word over and over again, because this is something we can't control. In life, we can always control things, we can fix them, and we can do something about it, and this is something we can't change and we can't control. So often, you're right, that powerlessness gets turned in at ourselves. In some people, there's an anger in grief, too. There's a no. You know, there's a no. I don't want this to be true. So sometimes that anger turns inward and it becomes guilt, too. Mm. So, and there are certain regrets, but we always have to remember that we do the best we can. You know, that's such an important thing to remind yourself over and over. You know, from far away, you did the best you could, and you didn't know this was going to happen. And, you know, you can tell that you care so much about your aunt and your family, and your feelings are so deep. So you have to just, you know, really have compassion for yourself and know this is such a hard thing that you've gone through. And I agree with Zara. It's a process, so it takes time. But if ever, when I'm there next, we can have a walk and a talk more about this.
Absolutely, I would love to.
Yeah, it would be great.
So when this happened, I was like, I just knew that I needed a big hug, and I talked to somebody. Like, my partner supported me as much as he could, but still. So I was supposed to pick up something from Zara. She had saved a cake, slice of cake for me. Mm-hmm. And so I went upstairs, and I just knew. I was like, you know, I told Kevin, it's going to be a while. So, and then I just started crying when I saw her face, and I was like, yeah, I have to tell her. And she gave me a big hug, and then we spoke about this. And yeah, that was very helpful at that point. Yeah,
it really felt, I felt very honored that you felt comfortable confiding in me. And, you know, part of our bonding and our relationship as friends has been that we share food with each other.
I want to hear what some of the things
that
you
shared. I thought we should talk about that because it's been really like, it's a big part of, like, our friendship, and it's also just been a part of, like, how I think our building has come together a bit, you know? But it's, I think our particular bond over sharing food together is really sweet, and it make, like, I'll cook something, and I'm like, I'm going to make a little bit extra for her and bring it down. And yeah, like, I mean, you and Kevin came to the Zaza pop-up. I think that was kind of the beginning of, like, us enjoying each other's cooking.
Yeah, it was great because we moved in January this year, and Zara came up to say hi, and she mentioned about a pop-up. And then within a few weeks, we had placed an order, and we came to pick up at Shelsky's. And yeah, then there was no looking back. I was like, okay, I love her food. This is amazing and so warm. And my mom always says you can taste the love that person puts into the food through their food. Like, you can just taste it. And I tasted that warmth. And I was like, yeah, I need to, you know, work on this relationship. Like,
it was sweet.
Explore
so
this.
You bring me up. Can you tell us a little bit about, like, some of the things that you brought up for me? You always bring up the most delicious Indian food. I mean, truly, like, beyond. I feel so blessed every time I get a text from you saying, would you like a little bit of this or that? I'm like, oh my God, of course, yes. I would never say no to your food. It's so good. So what are some of, like, your kind of, like, do you remember any of specifics of stuff you brought to me?
So it's mostly vegetarian, and it's, so every time I would cook something nice, I would be like, this tastes good. Maybe I can share it with Zara. So it was like eggplant once, mm-hmm. eggplant and potatoes.
Delicious.
With tomato base. It's called alu bengin, and that with fried bread, right? Which is puri.
That was so delicious. I mean,
and with a side of raita.
I ate that so fast. Like, just stand. Usually I have to confess, when you bring me food, I don't even sit down to, like, you know, make a plate of it. I just, like, eat it out of the container standing up. And I'm like, I'll just try a bite of this. And then I am like, wow, I just ate all this in 30 seconds. It's so good.
Yeah, it's normally not a very big portion. It's like a small portion, like just, you know, a serving. And yeah, with some raita on the side. And I would love to have you over. And it's just that, you know, with COVID and everything,
I know it's tough.
Never had an opportunity.
But we're going to make it happen. We're going to have a dinner party very soon, and I'm truly, like, just so excited for it. I can't wait.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, I love it. It's one of the greatest. It makes me feel, like, just to connect to what we were talking about earlier in the show, to, like, I don't know, the feeling of feeling alone in such a big city of people and in such a big world, honestly, you know? And I think it's so tethering to find people who, like, were strangers weeks ago, you know what I mean? And then all of a sudden they're not. And that can just happen, right? Like, anything else can kind of just happen. And you just have to open your heart to it. You know what I mean? It's like any other kind of relationship or opportunity, although this is one that's, like, kind of can be easier to make, and finding ways we can connect with people. Well, it doesn't always have to be over food, but food is a great connector.
Yes.
You know, and if you're feeling lonely and you live in a building where you feel like you don't know anyone, maybe you need a friend. I don't know. Maybe it sounds a little hokey or corny or too easy, but, like, maybe it's not. Maybe it's possible to be like, hey, I, like, made this pan of brownies. Like, do you want one? You know, and just seeing, like, where that kind of warmth, because also, like, you never know who could really fucking use a brownie that you made. Sometimes exactly. It's like the gesture is bigger than you
and
could understand.
Means. Well, it reminds us of a quote that we often use on the show, and it was from Viktor Frankl, who was a Holocaust survivor and a psychiatrist, and he would say that survival is a community event. So it's true, you know, and if we don't have our community, if our families, then we have to create new community. So that's what you did in Cobble Hill, and that's such a beautiful thing.
In
Carroll Gardens.
Yeah, it's been great. So we ask everyone on every show the same thing, which is that if you could have given yourself a piece of advice at the beginning of this kind of grief experience, that you, wherever you see yourself needing it, you know, at whatever point, what would that be, knowing what you kind of know now and having gone through, you know, a lot of the processes of it?
I would say don't be too hard on yourself, because I beat myself up. I used to, at least, every day, like, you know, I wasn't there for her, and, you know, but I tried, so I would not do that.
Yay.
I would strictly steer clear of that, and yeah, be there for my family, and I did my best.
Yes.
I am there for my family day in, day out, literally. I call them up in the morning, call them up in the evening, like, no matter how busy I am.
That's right.
So I'm trying my best, and so... Yeah,
that
is true.
Do not be hard on yourself.
It's great advice, because here's the thing. It doesn't make anything better.
Right.
It doesn't take anything away.
Makes you suffer more.
It doesn't make the person come back. It doesn't, like, prove anything. It just makes your life that you still have worse. And it's just like, it doesn't, you know, it's reasonable to have feelings of guilt and stuff, but you have to at some point look at yourself and be like, who is this serving? I always ask myself that when I'm being hard on myself about stuff. I'm like, who is this for? You know, is this performative? Is this to, like, you know, what is this actually
And it's
serving?
It's healing to forgive yourself.
Yeah.
It's healing.
Yeah.
It is.
So
absolutely.
I want you to just read a little poem. Is that okay?
Oh, of course.
This is from a very famous, I don't know how many people know John Donahue, but he was...
Related to Phil Donahue?
No.
I'm just kidding.
And he actually died. I was at a conference once and he was supposed to speak and he died right before the conference. And so I learned more about him. But he said, "Let us not look for you only in memory, where we would grow lonely without you. You would want us to find you in presence, besides us when beauty brightens, when kindness glows and music echoes eternal tones, when orchards brighten the earth, darkest winter has turned into spring. May this dark grief flower with hope in every heart that loves you."
Beautiful.
That's beautiful, Bobby. Thanks for sharing that with us.
I look it up and save it.
Okay, we'll send it to you. Myself.
We'll send you the poem.
Yeah,
that would be lovely.
I like to read poems because what we said before, grief and loss and death is just eternal. It's just what happens. So it happens to all of us. So I like to hear what other people have said about it. I like to hear poems that were written in the 12th century about grief. I like to hear about what everyone talks about because we all have to help each other. And that's a lot what our show is about, you know, to try to help each other. And thank you so much. You're such a lovely, lovely, lovely person.
Oh my gosh, the loveliest person I've really ever met. Just so sweet.
Yes, she's all in my.
Should we ask our other question that we always ask? Which is that if we were, and this is going to be much more possible with you than probably any other guest we've had, we like to think that we could sit with our guests and share a meal and think about what we would all bring to the meal. And we can actually, this is achievable. We can share a meal and we will.
Yeah.
So, if we were to have a dinner, what would we bring? Do you want to start, Bobby?
No.
Bobby and I were joking today. How's this? She gets like stage fright when we go over this and often says the same thing, which I think is adorable and honest and very funny.
Oh,
all right,
so
I'll start. Because we're entering spooky season and the fall, it's October 1st as we're recording this. The fall, in my opinion, is the best time of the year. I'm going to bring a big hollowed out pumpkin that I roast and then hollow it out and make a delicious pumpkin risotto and put it back inside the pumpkin.
Ooh.
So like pumpkin, yummy, creamy risotto
delicious.
With sage and like brown butter.
Yum.
Yeah.
Wow. I guess what I'll bring, I don't know if it's going to fit in with
anything. Is it blueberry
else.
Lemonade, Bobby? It can't be. Don't say that.
I was thinking about the cabbages are.
Oh, yeah.
This is a season for cabbage. And from our culture, my mother was from Yugoslavia. So she taught me how to make cabbage, stuffed cabbage.
Oh, really?
So I would make stuffed cabbage, and it was a sweet and sour kind of lovely taste.
I think that would go lovely,
yeah.
Really good with
it
a
has
pumpkin
some,
risotto.
Some rice, and I would probably use turkey because I don't eat beef, but I would make a turkey rice filling, and I would make a sweet and sour cabbage sauce.
Mmm, yum.
Love it.
Okay.
Absolutely love it. I would bring, again, puri, because I love puri, and it's like we are celebrating, so.
Yeah.
Right? And chickpea.
Oh.
It's called chole, spiced chickpea, with a side of raita, with yogurt and some cucumber in it, and some dill, maybe.
Oh, I love that.
So,
that is, like, one of my favorite combinations. You made that, too, the delicious, like, chickpea, spiced chickpeas with yogurt. I love that. And that sounds perfect. This is going to be a
this
amazing.
Meal goes
we
well.
Can, we can make this meal. We can make this happen.
Yes.
And we will.
Absolutely. I'm down for it.
Thank you so much. You are a wonderful human being. And it was so great to have you on the show. And we really can't wait. I can't wait to see you again, which is going to be soon. I'll be home on Sunday. And so we'll have to
perfect.
Plan a meal and definitely plan a time where we can all hang out.
And I feel so blessed that you have such a lovely neighbor and part of your community, part of your family.
Yes, it's very nice.
Thank you so much for having me here. And it's been quite something because I wasn't ready to share my feelings or talk about it to myself.
Yeah.
So this was a great exercise, like unpacking everything and facing it, not being in denial.
Lavanya,
thank you so much.
You are so wonderful and special, and we thank you so much for coming on and sharing with us. This is a great, great episode.
Thank you so much.
Okay, we'll talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Talk soon. Bye-bye.
This episode is brought to you by Wisconsin Cheese. There's a reason when you think of Wisconsin, you think cheese. Cheese is a huge part of Wisconsin's history and future. In Wisconsin, the state of cheese, The tradition of cheesemaking excellence began 180 years ago, before Wisconsin was recognized as a state. Immigrants traveled to settle in this lush, green hills of Wisconsin, bringing their cheesemaking traditions with them. These storied skills, combined with the freshest milk available, created a cheesemaking culture that is uniquely Wisconsin. Wisconsin's 1,200 cheesemakers, many of whom are third and fourth generation, continue to pass on old world traditions while adopting modern innovations in cheesemaking craftsmanship. Find your next favorite cheese at wisconsincheese.com.
Thank you so much for joining us for Processing. We realize that sharing these types of deeply intimate stories on air is a very personal decision. We began this project as a way to connect our listeners through shared experiences and storytelling. We hope that Processing can be a platform for sharing, learning, and healing. We appreciate our guests' willingness to be vulnerable and value nothing more than making both our guests' and listeners' experiences with our show positive and progressive. If you're interested in being a guest on the show or writing in a listener letter, please email processing@heritageradionetwork.org. Please follow us at processing_podcast on Instagram. Processing is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, and more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click at the heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.